We'll spend the first part of today's broadcast looking at revealing results recently out of Kansas State University in collaboration with others in the beef cattle research arena. And it shed some light on a concern that arose many months ago now about cattle mobility coming out of the feedlot and arriving at the packing plant. Joining us now is the director of the Beef Cattle Institute and a K-State veterinarian, Dan Thompson. Dan, this was a much publicized scenario, which we'll cover here, but let's go back to the origins of the question and then how you and your colleagues approached it, if you would.
You bet. Well, thanks, Eric, and appreciate you having me on.
You bet.
This is one of those that in the July of 2013, there was the initial break of what we call the fatigue cattle syndrome that we know it today. Mm-hmm. But it was at packing plants in Idaho in the Pacific Northwest, and they had cattle that would, when they would arrive at the packing plant, they were stiff, they were unable to move, they were short of breath, and it was the thing that was then later discovered or later named to be an caused by Zilmax or the beta agonist. And that case led to the removal of that product off the market voluntarily by Merck Animal Health. And since then, we, our group, number one, I was asked to be a clinical investigator of those cases by the packer and by the pharmaceutical companies. And from our findings in the clinical setting, we then have established some modeling and different tests along the way, two or three different PhD students working on looking at how this fatigue cattle syndrome is set up, what are the clinical signs, what are some things we can do to prevent it.
And before we get into the particulars of the work at hand, this was when it emerged a significant animal welfare issue, and that's what shed so much light on it.
Yeah, at the end of the day, we had cattle that were finished cattle coming into the packing plant, couldn't move. They were starting to slough their hooves, mm-hmm. and it caused a huge animal welfare awareness. And this, as you can remember, in 2013, this went across the country. This was on every news. I probably had someone call me from Reuters or ABC or some news agency two or three times a week for up to 4 or 5 months. They're awfully persistent. I wouldn't answer their calls, you know, because I didn't feel as my place as someone in academia to make any guesses as to why it happens. Let's just figure it out, and that's what we've done.
And you and your partners went after this how? What observations did you take? And we should acknowledge your partners as well here, too.
You bet. We did a lot of research on this paper, particular paper, the paper that we published in the Journal of the American Veterinary Medical Association describing fatigue cattle syndrome as a first group to describe it, and it's kind of its home then and discovery is Kansas State University. But we had colleagues, Jamie Henningsen at the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, Bawa Badorfia from also K-State's Diagnostic Lab. He has since left the D-Lab for a private entity. Steve Inslee at Iowa State and Guy Lonergan at Texas Tech University. Guy's an epidemiologist that has done some things with us in the past. Steve Inslee's a toxicologist at Iowa State. He's from Onega, Kansas. So he's a wildcat. need to get him hired back down here in Manhattan. But anyway, great group. We started out taking samples from the animals. First of all, you have to look at the clinical signs. And like I say, these animals they couldn't move. They were tied up, almost like what you hear with tying up in horses. They were sloughing their hooves and shortness of breath. You could tell the animals were extremely stressed. They would go down and they couldn't get back up. And so that's what the animals looked like. Then we did, you know, diagnostic workup, and the animals were euthanized, the ones that succumbed to this syndrome. And we were able to look at high lactate levels, which lactic acid buildup when your muscles are stressed, and that makes a lot of sense, that why the animals were tied up and stiff. But then high levels of creatine phosphokinase, which is CPK, and that is an enzyme that is indicative of muscle damage or muscle tissue damage. So whenever you get – and it's very much involved with crushing injuries – or if someone gets hit in football, I can't imagine what some of our CPK levels are Saturday morning or Sunday morning, depending on if you're high school or college. But CPK levels go up when we have the increase in lactate in the blood and CPK, that's when we start to see this syndrome. Those are really the trigger points diagnostically of when we're going to see and what we're going to see. Otherwise, it's pretty diagnostically unremarkable.
So what instigates those conditions then? Has that been determined yet?
Yeah, and so we went back and looked at our colleagues in the swine industry, and they have what they call fatigue pig syndrome. Mm-hmm. Same clinical signs, same diagnostic evaluation, increased lactate, increased CPK. And they went back to how big we're feeding some of these animals, okay? Used to be a 240-pound hog was a market hog. Mm-hmm. And now we're feeding them upwards of 300 pounds. Cattle 10, 15, 20 years ago, we'd feed them up to 1,200, 1,250. And now we bump everything up against that 1,400, 1,500-pound finish weight. And so just number one, the increase in the amount of size of the animals and how heavy we're feeding these animals today is number one. Then we start looking at any causes of stress. And some of the old research would show that double-muscled cattle versus normally muscled cattle, if exposed to physical stress such as running or nutritional stress such as feed removal or just some sort of stress of giving a shot of epinephrine, that they would respond much differently physiologically, increase in lactate, increase in CPK, than animals with less muscling. So as we increase the size of the animals, we increase the amount of muscle. As we improve genetics towards a leaner, more muscled carcass, we're changing the conformation of these animals. And so anytime we have these finished cattle, at the point of time of slaughter, we really have to be careful on how we're going to handle them. And so from our standpoint, we've done a series of experiments. We can actually cause fatigue cattle syndrome by running cattle. If you run them when you're going to go to load out, one of the ways to prevent this from occurring is make sure you walk the cattle to the load out.
Low stress handling.
Absolutely. Maybe we want to have a lead rider that's in front of those cattle, not let them go faster than a walk. Maybe we want to move cattle 30, 40 days prior to shipping up to pens that are closer to the load out than being a mile away at the back of the yard or something to that nature. You know, beta agonists have been implicated. But really, we've shown in cattle that are fed beta agonist, we can prevent this from happening. We can cause the syndrome in cattle that have never been exposed to a beta agonist. So that alone is not the cause. It goes back to long-term and short-term stress. You know, shipping cattle at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when it's 110 degrees out, cattle get to the plant and sit on the truck for a little while, things to that nature. We really have to take care of, if we're going to feed these cattle to bigger weights, what we have found is to prevent fatigue cattle syndrome, you've got to remove all the stressors, whether it's heat stress, whether it's transport stress, whether it's loading stress, running those cattle in the alleyways, time of day that we ship. All of these different interactions are what continue to mount different stress responses until the animal exhibits the final clinical signs, which is this fatigue cattle syndrome at the plant.
So this can be managed, Dan?
It is a management issue. At the end of the day, this is a management issue. And it's not just a management issue at the feed yard because, you know, when packers are asking us to ship cattle at 2 in the afternoon for B shift, I think that there's going to have to be some consideration for the cattle that we don't need to be moving them at the heat of the day. I think something like that's going to have to change as well. I think the thing that this has taught me, we weren't seeing the signs at the feed yard, so the feed yard really didn't know there was an issue. We're seeing the signs at the plant, and the timing of Zilmax and the timing of things, I think people were making assumptions of why things were happening or if things were being made up, you know, because we don't see it at the yard and you're saying you see it at the plant. What it really showed me is that our segments of the industry have to communicate. We're no longer, although we have different accounts and we're working off of different sets of books and we're paying each other and we're each other's customers and clients, the communication on the sake of the cattle is what we really have to focus on.
So really the answer, if you will, to novel fatigue syndrome in cattle is animal husbandry more than anything else.
Yeah, I wish that it was something cool and we'd invent some antidote for it. But, you know, the longer I'm around this business and that, you know, our problems aren't different. It's just different people and different cattle going through it. And most everything is answered with husbandry and management and taking care of those cattle.
Hats off to all involved here, for this was a highly important finding for the beef cattle industry, as this mysterious condition started showing up a couple of years ago and led to some actions which the end may not have been warranted in regard to beta agonists. It's providing confirmation of what's called fatigue cattle syndrome. Dan, thanks for letting us know what you've discovered here.
Thanks for what you do, Eric.
He's the director of the Beef Cattle Institute at Kansas State University. Dan Thompson has been our guest on Agriculture Today.